Well, good evening, everyone. It's my my pleasure to introduce the public lecture this evening. I should say that we hold a seminar series in the third term each year, that is to say, what's called the All London Centre, or the All London Seminar, organised mainly by the Centre for the Philosophy of the Natural and Social Sciences at the LSE. We hold a seminar series each third term, and it's generally at least partly thematised. And we have graduate students, PhD students, and other people from Imperial and King's and so on, UCL, the Wellcome coming along, usually very lively discussion. And one of the nice features about this seminar series is that we usually pick up one of the themes from the series and invite along a distinguished speaker at the end of the series or close to the end of the series to talk about one of the themes that we've discussed. Now, one of the themes we talked about this term was the history of objectivity. And I'm delighted to be able to welcome Lorraine Daston. Professor Daston has a chair at the Humboldt University in Berlin. She's also one of the directors of the Max Planck Gesellschaft Institute.
No, the Vatican Institute for
Institute. I'm sure that Professor Daston's work is known to many people here. She's written extremely widely, both in terms of period from the medieval period through until the late 19th century, and extremely impressively in terms of breadth of subject from the life and physical sciences through to the history of mathematics, most notably the history of probability theory. Now, one of Professor Daston's, I think, ongoing projects is writing a history of the changing notion of objectivity from the medieval period through until present day, I suppose, which you've undertaken partly with me together.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. And I think clearly it's partly from that research and from our point of view, in the context of the discussions we've had this term, that Professor Daston is going to speak this evening to the title Objectivity and the Cosmic Community.
Thank you very much for the introduction and the invitation, and thanks especially to all of you who came during what I am told is absolutely the most frenetic week of the academic year. The term scientific community is a distinctly odd one. Despite the cozy neighborly associations of community, the scientific community is a far-flung association whose members are dispersed in time and space, who communicate with one another primarily through print, be it on the printed page or now the computer screen, rather than through face-to-face conversations, and who pride themselves on pointedly ignoring all the specificities of person, nationality, creed, race, confession, politics, taste, class, region, that have traditionally bound communities together. This is, of course, an idealized picture. In an age of international conferences, visiting professorships, and the worldwide traffic in postdocs, there may be greater opportunity to meet and size one another up in person than ever before. And there are, of course, notorious examples, Deutsche Physik, Lysenkoism, in which scientists have allowed their allegiances to nation or ideology to overrule their science. The reality of the scientific community may belie the ideal, and thereby bring it closer to the clannishness of most other real communities. But my interest here for the moment is in the ideal itself and its peculiar combination of distance and proximity. On the one hand, distance, both literal and figurative. Members of the scientific community are scattered all over the globe and even throughout history. They cultivate impersonality, though not anonymity. They attempt to transcend all that is local, idiosyncratic, and variable in themselves and in nature. On the other hand, proximity. In cases of conflict, loyalty to the scientific community is expected to trump loyalty to all the other communities to which a scientist may belong, even to the family. Measured by the number of waking hours devoted to work, as opposed to any other pursuit, Scientists value the good opinion of a handful of colleagues more than that of their nearest and dearest or the powers that be. Conversely, when in the novel Middlemarch, George Eliot tells us that Lydgate is going to allow his young wife Rosamond the last damning word on Vesalius's grave robbing in the service of anatomy, when we hear this, we know that Lydgate's own scientific career is doomed. "Oh," said Rosamond, with a look of disgust on her pretty face, "I'm very glad you are not Vesalius. I should have thought he might find some less horrible way than that." The ties among the members of the scientific community bind tightly, and perhaps the word community is not so inapt after all. There are doubtless precedents for such scattered but intensely loyal confraternities. One thinks of the remarkable international organization of the Society of Jesuits in the 17th century, or the Republic of Letters, inhabited by early modern humanists and Enlightenment philosophers. But the scientific community has distinctive features which are all its own. Neither Jesuits nor citizens of the Republic of Letters understood impersonality as a precondition for their communities. Jesuit missionaries like Matteo Ricci and Jesuit savants like Athanasius Kirchhill cultivated flamboyant personal styles and reputations, albeit within the boundaries of a strictly defined orthodoxy. And the tribunes of the Republic of Letters hoped their works would bring them personal immortality in the intellectual pantheon. Even the scientific province of the 18th century Republic of Letters was not yet a scientific community in the modern sense. Academies may have exchanged proceedings, and there were a few fleeting international collaborations. But the real communicative bonds were friendships or enmities between individual savants, nourished by lifelong correspondences. These were highly selective bonds established between peers, and even if the relationship never progressed from pen pals to in-person meetings, the correspondences often became more intimate over the years, with personal revelations strewn among scientific findings. In contrast, the scientific community that emerged in the latter half of the 19th century went hand in hand with a variety of objectivity that aimed at the elimination of the idiosyncratic and the ineffable in science, which I shall call communitarian objectivity. In this lecture, I propose to examine what kind of science enshrined communitarian objectivity and when, why, and how it did so. But first, what exactly is communitarian objectivity? It is an epistemic ideal that enshrines the kind of knowledge that can be shared among knowers, regardless of their individual peculiarities. More accurately, the knower in question is no longer an individual, but a community extended indefinitely in space and time. I take the name communitarian objectivity from Charles Sanders Peirce, who put it thus in 1868. The real, then, is that which, sooner or later, information or reasoning would finally result in, and which is therefore independent of the vagaries of me and you. Thus, the very origin of the conception of reality shows that this conception essentially involves the notion of community in the original community is in all capital letters, without definite limits and capable of an indefinite increase in knowledge, end quote. It was Kant who first used the word objective for this kind of shared knowledge, as opposed to what he called the subjective opinion of the individual in a passage near the end of the First Critique. He writes, "If judgment is valid for everyone, provided only he is in possession of reason, its ground is objectively sufficient, and the holding of it to be true is entitled objective conviction. If it has its ground only in the special character of the subject, it is entitled subjective persuasion." That is, in order to be objective, shared knowledge need not necessarily be about the external world. Thoughts might also qualify, but it must be communicable. As the logician Gottlob Frege put it in his criticism of those who conflated the objectivity of geometry with spatial intuitions, what is objective therein, that is, in geometry, is the law governed, the conceptual, the judgeable, what can be expressed in words. The purely intuitive, das rein Anschauliche, is not communicable. More recently, the philosopher Thomas Nagel has expressed the ideas of communitarian objectivity in the language of viewpoint, or rather the absence of any, writing, "A view or form of thought is more objective than another if it relies less on the specifics of the individual's makeup and position in the world, or on the character of the particular type of creature he is. The wider the range of subjective types to which a form of understanding is accessible, the less it depends on specific subjective capacities, the more objective it is," end quote. This conception of objectivity as the Venn diagram intersection of what, in Nagel's words, the widest possible range of subjective types would assent to is by now so entrenched that we need to be reminded explicitly of the alternatives. Why should the peculiarities of an individual's corporeal and spiritual makeup be a matter of indifference or even an obstacle to the discovery of truth? The universality of truth by no means implies that all are equally qualified to discern it. And perhaps this is why the history of philosophy, from Diogenes Laertius to well into the 19th century, was so crammed with biographic details about Socrates and Seneca and Descartes and Hume, for life and works were believed to be intertwined. Even if the moral component of these vitae is left aside, the peculiar turn of mind of a Bacon or a Kant was considered a help rather than a hindrance to their inquiries into the nature of things. The Enlightenment adulation of Newton as demigod was premised upon his intellectual uniqueness. Newton, childlike sage, sagacious reader of the works of God, as William Cowper put it. In the realm of empirical science, the ability to split a double star with the naked eye, as Hipparchus was reputed to be able to do, or identify nearly 1,000 species, as Linnaeus was able to, or perform a delicate precision measurement, are as idiosyncratic as any other form of sensory acuity or manual dexterity, yet nonetheless of epistemological import. It might be countered that the requirements of communitarian objectivity need only be served in the context of justification, not that of discovery. There is a difference between finding and spreading the truth. But the very requirements that experiments be replicable, observers interchangeable, and mathematical proofs free of appeals to intuition, in short, what we have come to call the context of justification, appeared only in the mid-19th century, alongside the new ideals and practices of objectivity. To frame the question somewhat differently, must all knowledge be public in order to be worthy of the name? Cannot certain individuating traits, a capacious memory, sharp senses, vast experience of a certain place or class of things, analytic penetration, be epistemological advantages? We may recoil, for political and moral reasons, from the implications of the ancient view that truth flourishes best among a small group of initiates, but it is not clear that we should do so for epistemological reasons. How, then, did communitarian objectivity establish itself so successfully in the 19th century sciences and become elevated not only to a philosophical, but also to a methodological and moral ideal? Scientific objectivity was indeed born in the mid-19th century, and it was twice born. When in 1884, the German bacteriologist Robert Koch called photographs of microorganisms a purely objective account, or when in 1875, Charles Sanders Peirce insisted that the validity of scientific inferences inexorably requires that our own interests not stop at our own fate, but must embrace the whole community, they were coining slogans and pioneering methods for two then novel and distinct forms of scientific objectivity: the mechanical objectivity of the photograph and the communitarian objectivity of the map. Each form of objectivity arose to counteract specific and different aspects of the personal in science, and each was constituted by a characteristic ethos and equally characteristic techniques and procedures. Also characteristic were the images produced by each, the mechanically reproduced photograph and the communally constructed map, which were at once emblematic and constitutive of their respective ideals. Both mechanical and communitarian objectivities were deeply moralized, reforming the persona as well as the protocols of the scientist. But here as well, each imposed a distinctive ethos of self-discipline. In what follows, I'm going to confine myself mostly to the distinctive practices, images, and morals of communitarian objectivity, since Peter Gallison and I have written a few years back a rather long article on mechanical objectivity. But I will bring in mechanical objectivity from time to time simply to sharpen my claims about the specificity of communitarian objectivity. I don't want you to lose sight of my claim that objectivity, from its very outset, was plural in nature. Communitarian objectivity countered the subjectivity of idiosyncrasy and parochialism, not only of the individual scientist, but increasingly also of the individual, of the local research group. It emerged in the mid-19th century in response to a new form of scientific inquiry, namely the sustained international collaboration. The 18th century had witnessed a few scientific collaborations on an international scale, most notably the expeditions to observe the transits of Venus in 1761 and 69. However, these cooperative efforts were few and episodic, with no binding consequences for the participants. Enterprises undertaken in common in the latter half of the 19th century, like the Internationale Gradmessung Project or the standardization of electrical units, were in contrast long-term and quasi-contractual, obligating participants to reform their procedures and techniques. Improved means of transportation and communication were the preconditions for, but not the causes, of these ever wider and more densely woven networks of observers. Rather, a new awareness of natural phenomena that dwarfed merely human scales of time and space prompted the organization of vast observational systems with standardized methods and instruments. The shape and path of a storm, the contour of an isotherm, the physiognomy of a landscape, the geographical distribution of a species. These were phenomena whose regularities, or even very existence, was hidden to the observer located too firmly in the here and now, whose view might be circumscribed by the humanly meaningful coordinates of a locale or a lifetime. Mechanical and communitarian objectivities addressed different epistemological problems in science. Upholders of mechanical objectivity worried about how human intervention might distort natural phenomena. Upholders of communitarian objectivity fretted about how anthropocentric scales of time and space might fail to register certain phenomena altogether. Their metaphysics differed accordingly. Scientists who were most alarmed by intervention focused on the individual phenomenon in all its here and now concreteness and regarded composites with suspicion. Those, on the other hand, most fearful of Lilliputian parochialism pieced together their often invisible objects from reports filed from around the world over decades and branded the individual phenomenon misleading. Mechanical and communitarian objectivity also dictated subtly different scientific moralities, each intent on suppressing a different facet of the self. Whereas mechanical objectivity exhorted its practitioners to austere self-restraint in judgment and interpretation in the name of authenticity, communitarian objectivity demanded the equally severe curtailment of individual or local autonomy in the choice of instruments, methods, and even research topics in the name of solidarity. If the emblem of mechanical objectivity was the unretouched photograph, the emblem of communitarian objectivity was the global map of the whole earth or the entire dome of the heavens, composed like a mosaic from a community of far-flung observers, each contributing a fragment to the whole. Photograph and map converged in the most ambitious of 19th century scientific collaborations, the photographic mapping of the heavens known as the Carte du Ciel, or the Great Star Map. I'm going to concentrate on the Carte du Ciel, not because it is representative in its scale for these scientific collaborations. It dwarfs almost all other scientific collaborations undertaken at this time. But I do think, nonetheless, it is typical in the Baconian sense of being a shining instance. That is, it brings out in sharpest and most exaggerated form the kind of objectivity that was required in order to make such a collaboration practicable. In April of 1887, 58 astronomers from 16 countries plus three colonies met in Paris at the invitation of the Admiral E.B. Mouchet, director of the Paris Observatory, to plan what one contemporary called the greatest undertaking ever launched in astronomy. namely a complete photographic map of the sky, including all stars to the 14th magnitude. As the largest and longest of the projects launched in the late 19th century, the Carte du Ciel collaboration throws the characteristic ideals and practices of communitarian objectivity into relief. Only the combined and prolonged efforts of almost a score of observatories in both the northern and southern hemispheres could produce what promoters hailed as a monument for the ages through which the science of the 19th century, in the words of one promoter, will leave to posterity the imperishable and unimpeachable state of the starry sky, which in future centuries will serve as the certain basis for the solution of the grand problem of the general constitution of the universe. The proportions of the project were monumental in every sense. 18 observatories around the world, from Helsinki at about 61 degrees north to Melbourne at about 37 degrees south, labored for decades. The publication of the catalog, and even then it was not really complete, occurred in 1964. They labored then for decades to amass charts which already in 1912 were projected to stack 32 feet high and weigh 4,000 pounds. Just to give you an idea of the observatories that originally were participating in this effort. The thing to note especially is, of course, the distribution according to latitude in order to get the entire globe of the sky, but also the percentages. You'll notice that those observatories, especially here, Rio de Janeiro, Cape of Good Hope, Sydney, and Melbourne, which are in the southern hemisphere, have a significantly larger share of the sky than those in the northern hemisphere. This led to what many astronomers in the southern hemisphere, to this very day, think of as a deeply unjust division of labor in the Carte du Ciel, which I'll say more in a moment. Armed with this snapshot of the sky circa 1900, they actually thought in 1887 they could finish it by 1900. This estimate proved to be wildly optimistic. But the hope was that future astronomers would then be able to detect changes in the heavens which unfolded on too long a time scale to be perceptible within a short human lifetime. So the appearance of new stars, nebulae, and comets, the telltale motion of as yet undiscovered planets, and the extended periods of variable stars. So by uniting astronomers around the world and across generations, the Carte du Ciel aspired to nature's own Leviathan scale. I might add here also to Peirce's indefinite community. The people who planned the Carte du Ciel in 1887 imagined that it would be the astronomers in the year 3000 who would be first using and extracting the fruits of their efforts. So there was something really quite akin to the medieval cathedrals in this undertaking. Although photography made this immense project conceivable, and although its supporters sometimes invoked the ideals of mechanical objectivity, it was the ideals of communitarian objectivity, that is, the ethos of the map constructed by many hands, that guided the makers of the Carte du Ciel. Astrophotography alone promised speed, permanence, and authenticity, but not globality and uniformity. I give you a sense of why photography was so important to this project. And it's for a reason that really, I think, permeates throughout the whole doctrine of mechanical objectivity. This is one of the early plates taken by the refractor in Paris by the brothers Bostel and Paul-Henri of the sky around the Pleiades. In the age before astrophotography, of course, there have been star maps, but it would have involved, especially when it went down to the 11th or even the 14th magnitude, an enormous amount of effort to draw all of these stars. And one of the very first rationales for scientific photography, which emerges very, very early on, the 18th and 20th, almost immediately after the first experiments in this medium by Daguerre and Talbot, is that this was a labor-saving device, that what it would do would be to capture an almost infinite amount of detail effortlessly. The argument of authenticity, the argument that was to be so central to mechanical objectivity, emerges only later as an argument for using photographs as opposed to artists. And it is indeed this earlier argument about capturing infinite detail with a minimum of labor which was paramount in the Carte du Ciel use of astrophotography. As the deliberations of the 1887 International Congress and subsequent meetings of the Permanent Committee make clear, intricate coordination of telescopes, photographic plates, micrometric measurements, and myriad other details was essential to ensure that the parts of the map would be commensurable. Commensurability, in turn, required that participants relinquish control not only over instruments and methods, but also over the choice of research areas for years to come. The debate over the kind of telescope to be used in the photographic work of the Carte du Ciel shows how dearly uniformity and globality were sometimes purchased, especially in the view of the British astronomers. Although British astronomers had pioneered astrophotography, particularly in the work of Andrew Ainslie Common and Isaac Roberts, they had used a reflecting telescope. And although, unlike refractors, reflectors could be used for both visual and photographic observations, the reason this was so was that the optimal wavelength for visual astronomy and for the photographic film being used at the time were different, which made the refractor rather problematic because one would have to choose which wavelength would be the focal point. The reflectors, however, didn't have this disadvantage. They were much more versatile in their use. Nonetheless, despite these advantages of the reflector over the refractor, Common and Roberts recommended that the reflector should yield to the refractor in a work to be undertaken in concert. Common praised the reflector as the best instrument in all respects for celestial photography, but conceded that its proper use demanded long and careful experiments, in contrast to the refractor, whose manipulation was easily learned. Robert seconded the point that the reflector required the exercise of great care and patience and a thorough personal interest on the part of the observer using it. In the hands of such a person, it yielded excellent results, but in other hands, it might be a bad instrument. This does not come through in printed sources, but if one looks at the correspondence with Mouché, who coordinated the project from Paris, the Paris Observatory, with the various collaborating observatories, it's clear that from the very beginning, the European participants were dubious about the skills of their colleagues in colonial observatories, and that is what Roberts is referring to here. Neither Common nor Roberts was confident that all observers in so large and international an undertaking would command the necessary skill and patience. Therefore, they concluded, for the sake of securing uniformity in the operations of a large number of astronomers, the refractor ought to be adopted. And the refractor that was adopted was that which was used at the Paris Observatory to take this picture by their brothers, Paul and Olby. Here they are with their refractor at the Paris Observatory. Not just for, especially for the British astronomers, a sacrifice of their long-honed skills using the telescope of Newton, the reflector, but also considerable financial investment. Each of these telescopes had to be made new for the project and cost then 44,000 French francs. The dome, the special dome that was required to fit the telescope, cost an additional 21,000 francs. So the investment was considerable just in economic terms. It was characteristic of the project that certain instrument makers were granted near monopolies on manufacturing the instruments that were needed for the project. In the case of the refractors, it was the firm of Grob in Dublin and the firm of Gautier in Paris which divided the labor of making the telescopes between them. The flattening pressure of uniformity was also exerted on superior precision in the measurement of the plates to determine stellar positions. By resorting to the labor of poorly paid schoolboys and outright volunteers, the Oxford astronomer H.H. Turner was able to complete at least that part of the astrographic catalog assigned by the International Congress to his observatory already in 1911, although the Oxford contribution to the photographic map was never completed. Impatient with those observatories still in arrears in developing their portion of the Carte du Ciel, Turner chided his colleagues elsewhere for indulging in what he deemed an excess of precision in the measurement of their plates. And just to give you an idea of what order of magnitude we're talking about here,
pretty Observatory is forecasted to have to not only deliver, but also measure. And that is Turner's point in the following quotation. He admonishes his colleagues that the whole Cap du Ciel project was in jeopardy, work that under the best of conditions was to have taken 20 years, that is to have been finished around 1900, now threatened to drag on for 40. Turner concluded, the fact is that the necessity for strenuous economy has not been sufficiently realized. Some of the larger observatories strained at an accuracy scarcely possible even for them. He's thinking here especially, I think, of Potsdam. And their weaker brethren, in attempting to copy their example, have been left far behind. Moderation and self-denial are just as necessary in astronomical work as in other walks of life. Turner's stern appeal to self-denial in the context of getting on with the Cap du Ciel project was of a somewhat different kind than the self-restraint preached by the proponents of mechanical objectivity, albeit no less moralized in tone. Individual scientists ought to exercise self-restraint in judgment and interpretation, lest their voices drown out nature's own. In contrast, individuals or local research groups were admonished to practice self-denial in their choice of equipment and methods, lest local peculiarities jeopardize the joint effort to grasp nature as a whole. The levels of sacrifice demanded by communitarian objectivity were several: the cost and time and money of retraining and new instruments, the relinquishing of not only tried and true, but also sometimes demonstrably more accurate methods, the substitution of efficiency for painstaking precision, the monopolization of resources and personnel for long periods of routinized labor, the steadfast resistance to the temptation to neglect old collaborative commitments in pursuit of an exciting new discovery. These sacrifices were particularly grave for the small observatories participating in the Cap du Ciel. For example, the Australian observatories of Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, and Adelaide took 80 years to complete their assigned zones, which represented about 18% of the entire sky, at the price of limiting other investigations, particularly into the enormously fruitful fields of astrophysics and spectroscopy. When the Cap du Ciel was finally declared over in 1964, the Australian observatory said that because of their loyal commitment to the Cap du Ciel, most of 20th century astrophysics had passed them by. This was not only the case with those observatories which were so geographically situated as to have more than their share of the mapping effort. When I was doing the archival work for this project, I encountered an astronomer from Toulouse who noticed I was looking at the Cap du Ciel records, and the blood drained from his face, and he said, the Cap du Ciel ruined my observatory. Because when the Parisians got tired of the project, they, of course, farmed out all the labor of measuring the plates to the provinces. Conversely, there's a letter from Henry Bond, then director of the Harvard Observatory, to the Admiral Mouchet, refusing to take part in the Cap du Ciel on the grounds that it would be too much of a commitment for his observatory for too long a time. And it's no accident that Bond and the Harvard Observatory were the pioneers for astrophysical and spectral measurements. Under the circumstances, then, it's not surprising that astronomers conceived of their participation in the project in terms of, in the words of the director of the South African Observatory, David Gill, the deep sense of duty imposed upon us to bequeath a complete map of the sky to the astronomers of the year 3000 at least. It's also not surprising that the philosopher who articulated a moral and epistemological code based on the duties of communitarian objectivity should himself have been a node in several such mid-19th century networks of astronomical and geodetic observers. Charles Sanders Peirce was preoccupied both in his philosophy and in his scientific work with the necessity of individuals banding together into communities in order to understand nature aright. This philosophical precept was rooted in Peirce's own participation in international collaborations as delegate from the United States Coast and Geodetic Survey. Even his most technical scientific works invoke the ideals of communitarian objectivity in the context of specific experiments and scientific policies. In an 1879 memoir on the measurement of gravity at various points on the Earth's surface, for example, Peirce emphasized that, quote, the value of the gravity determinations depends upon their being bound together, each with all the others, which have been made anywhere upon the Earth. In order to grasp such a global phenomenon, participating scientists must be willing to sacrifice forms of action based on national exclusiveness,
for the solution of a great problem absolutely depends on international solidarity. What Peirce was referring to here specifically was the refusal of some of the participating countries to allow their pendulum, which was used to determine the gravity measures at various latitudes on the Earth's surface, to allow them to be calibrated at the Berlin Eichungsamt. Here were all the elements of communitarian objectivity, a global phenomenon which could only be studied by a network of observers using standardized methods, which in turn required the dutiful sacrifice of local interests for the common goal. Peirce did not scruple to identify parochialism with selfishness and to oppose its very existence to what he called the objectivity of knowledge. He drew self-consciously on the language of Christian self-abnegation to preach a scientific morality of objectivity, one which made supreme allegiance to the community the guarantee of all scientific inference. He concluded in words resonant of the gospel, "He who would not sacrifice his soul to save the whole world is, as it seems to me, illogical in all his inferences collectively." The global and even superglobal scientific undertakings that made communitarian objectivity their ethos required a strict standardization of instruments, images, protocols, and observers. But communitarian objectivity also extended to forms of scientific inquiry that did not require ambitious collaborations. It came to dictate the terms for what kind of knowledge could count as objective, even in the investigation of more localized phenomena by individual scientists. Returning to the passage from Kant's Canon of Reason, which I cited a moment ago, we find a rough and ready criterion for distinguishing the objective from the subjective. Kant tells us, "The touchstone whereby we decide whether our holding of a thing to be true is objective conviction or mere subjective persuasion is therefore external, namely the possibility of communicating it and of finding it to be valid for all human reason." This passage echoes through the writings of 19th century scientists and philosophers on objectivity. What is striking about the 19th century variations on this Kantian theme is how often communicability was made the rule of thumb for distinguishing not only the objective from the subjective, but also science from art. As the German physicist and physiologist Hermann von Helmholtz observed apropos of Goethe's scientific work, "Since artistic intuitions are not founded on the way to conceptual thinking, they do not permit themselves to be defined in words, whereas science works with concepts and what can be put in words." And we've already heard Frege on the necessity of communicability to objectivity. These pronouncements bristle, especially in German, with Kantian vocabulary and hint at the reason why Kant's informal remarks on communicability, as opposed to his much more elaborate analysis of objective validity, became so central to later formulations of scientific objectivity. In these later formulations, four distinct oppositions were superimposed on one another: art versus science, the intuitive versus the conceptual, the ineffable versus the communicable, and the subjective versus the objective. Although Kant would no doubt have disowned such a conflation, his famous contrast of artistic genius and scientific talent in the third critique cleared the way for these compressed polarities. "Art and science are both," said Kant, "ultimately governed by rules, but only the rules of science can be learned and taught. Nature dictates the rules of art through genius, but genius cannot, according to Kant, indicate scientifically, that is, wissenschaftlich, how it brings about its product, nor communicate the same to others in such precepts as would put them in a position to produce similar products. Hence, even the towering achievements of Newton do not qualify as genius, for, as Kant went on, the entire contents of his immortal work on the principles of natural philosophy may well be learned, however great a mind it took to find it all out. But we cannot learn to write in a true poetic vein, no matter how complete all the precepts of the poetic art may be, or however excellent its model." So the point is basically that if you read the Principia long and diligently enough, you would be in a position to reproduce its results and also to continue in that vein. But no matter how long you read Homer, you would not be in a position to write a Homeric epic. According to Kant, then, genius is not only originable, in contrast to the mere imitations of talent, it is also inscrutable, even to itself. Aesthetic ideas propel the mind into motion, yet, as Kant writes, without the possibility of any definite thought whatsoever. It is this mute opacity that distinguishes art from science, for science must traffic in concepts accessible to conscious introspection. Note that this is a deeper aphasia than the incommunicability mentioned at the end of the first critique. I may form an idea of a subjectively valid persuasion to myself without being able to translate it into an objectively valid conviction for others, but I can't make an aesthetic idea accessible even to my own consciousness. Kant praised the cumulative progress made possible by the communicability of science, but he also stressed the discouraging implications. In matters of science, therefore, the greatest inventor differs only in degree from the most laborious imitator and apprentice, whereas he differs in kind from one endowed by nature for fine art. Now, among scientists fired with the romantic cult of genius, there were many to dispute Kant's harsh judgment that they could aspire to no more than talent. However, the polarization between art and science intensified the perceptions of artists as well as scientists in the mid-19th century. Although it was conceivable that art might sometimes strive for objectivity, as Gustave Flaubert did in Madame Bovary, or that science might sometimes strive for subjectivity, as Alexander von Humboldt did in his Cosmos of 1845, such hybrids took on an increasingly oxymoronic quality in the latter half of the 19th century. So closely did art become identified with subjectivity and science with objectivity that works judged too close to the opposite pole could be criticized on these grounds alone as denatured. So, for example, the poet Charles Baudelaire scorned the landscape artists who confused the material science of photography with painting in their servile imitations of nature as too scientific, whereas the naturalist Georges Cuvier regretted British chemist Humphrey Davy's excursions into poetry and belles-lettres as too artistic. These ingrained oppositions of art and science came to define and refine the meanings of subjectivity and objectivity. Helmholtz makes a particularly instructive witness as to how ineluctable these oppositions had become, for he was a sensitive observer of the arts, especially of music, as well as a seminal contributor to several sciences. In lecture after lecture, Helmholtz deepened the contrast between the unconscious tact that guided artistic inductions about human character and the sharply explicit rules and laws characteristic of the sciences. No great painter, composer, or poet, said Helmholtz, worked consciously with general rules and abstractions, but scientists could not do without them. Art welled up spontaneously from the depths of unconscious memory. In contrast, according to Helmholtz, science was the conscious logical activity of our mind in its purest and most perfect form, accompanied by the unspontaneous virtues of painstaking care, exactitude, and caution. Science was, quoting now, the iron work of self-conscious inference that demands great stubbornness and caution. Art was intuition, the opposite of thinking, and without mental effort. In view of this contrast between laborious science and effortless art, it's perhaps surprising that bodily skill, with its affinity for hard work, should have ended up in the camp of subjectivity, alongside the free play of aesthetic ideas. Moreover, in contrast to the genial inspiration of the artist, the artisan's skill could be taught, albeit only by example and by submission to authority, as in the paradigm case of master and apprentice. What nonetheless yoked artist to artisan from the standpoint of scientific objectivity was the murkiness of their precepts. The knowledge of the hand could no more be dredged into consciousness than the rule nature gave to art. Even the 18th century French encyclopedists, champions of the arts and crafts, had complained of the inarticulate artisans who could demonstrate but not explain their handiwork. Thus, aesthetic intuitions and artisanal skill came to stand for the deepest, darkest form of subjectivity, that which eluded concepts and consciousness altogether. It was clear why proponents of communitarian objectivity, who were intent on holding together a global network of observers, would reject ways of knowing that could not even be articulated, much less standardized. If the division of scientific labor required by vast collaborations like the Carte du Ciel was to prove itself worth the sacrifices involved for the participants, and the results of observations and measurements at each of the nodes of the network must be made commensurable with one another. The problem was analogous, and was indeed perceived to be analogous, to that of modern manufacturing with interchangeable parts. Only with strict standardization could the parts be fit together into a functioning whole. In the context of communitarian objectivity, interchangeable observers replaced interchangeable parts. It's less clear, however, why communitarian objectivity should also seek to ban the ineffable in less tightly coordinated scientific undertakings. Knowledge in the form of results can be made public even if the methods by which it is attained remain private. Moreover, the validity of knowledge is not necessarily correlated with the ease of communicating it. A flash of insight, be it in mathematics or in poetry, may prove as robustly true as the most lucidly and laboriously constructed argument. Finally, words do not exhaust the possibility of communication. What cannot be formulated in rules and descriptions can often be taught or demonstrated by seeing and doing in person. Scientific travel, especially among experimentalists, makes possible exactly this kind of learning by example, which is why postdocs migrate to foreign labs in order to master a new technique rather than learning about it by reading an article comfortably at home. Tacit knowledge is not necessarily private knowledge. Why then expand the demands of communitarian objectivity to communication, and a rather restricted form of communication at that? Here, Peirce's idealized community of knowers, stretching across continents and centuries, bridges community and communication. If science itself was understood as a necessarily collective undertaking, all of its results count as part of a loose collaboration of knowers whose common object of investigation is the external world. The intuition that seems to inform both Kant's and Peirce's vision is that there is a single uniform world shared by many variable knowers. Insofar as the many knowers converge in their convictions, there is prima facie reason to believe that the cause of their conviction is the shared world. But in order to know whether or not their convictions converge, as well as to accumulate a store of collective knowledge, the knowers must be able to understand one another. Because they inhabit different locales and time periods, the conditions of their mutual intelligibility must be as decontextualized as possible, depending neither on geography, nor history, nor culture, nor the idiosyncrasies of mind and body. Language itself may be too context-bound to serve these purposes, as more than one 19th century spokesman for communitarian objectivity feared. But it was at least the time-honored medium of long-distance communication. The repression, but not suppression, of sensory acuity and bodily skill is most easily seen in the works of physiologists in the latter half of the 19th century. Tacit knowledge has always played a central role in medicine and physiology. Medicine had long straddled the boundary between science and art, but this amphibious status became intolerable only in the middle decades of the 19th century as science and art polarized into incommensurable ways of knowing. Many physicians with scientific ambitions hope to rescue their discipline from its undignified associations with handiwork on the one hand and trance-like divination on the other, by replacing the exquisitely honed senses of the seasoned physician with instruments, thermometers, sphygmometers, galvanometers. What these instruments seemed to promise was not simply greater precision, a precision which was, in many cases, open to doubt, since the readings of one instrument could vary wildly from those of another, but rather an objective substitute for the ineffable, irrevocably personal skills of the gifted clinician. The epistemological implications of the new instruments emerged most clearly where medicine intersected with laboratory physiology. Throughout the 19th century, physiologists had pioneered the invention of self-registering instruments, such as Helmholtz's Myographion of 1852. This is a device which allows the muscle, probes are put on the muscle at various points, each of which is attached to a rotating drum, and I'll show you in a moment what a myographium looks like, to trace the motion of the contraction. Or Carl Ludwig's Chymographion of 1846, which automatically records changes in the pressure of the arterial pulse. Or the work of Étienne-Charles Jules Maret on the curves traced by the sphygmometer. Maret hoped that these self-registering instruments would create a universal language which scientists would embrace in preference to the babble of their native tongues, writing, "Scientists of all nations bring documents for the common work, but each written in its own language, and the libraries bear witness to the burden and confusion." This is the Malay Acknowledger, which has the great advantage of being portable, and therefore could be used in a sick room as well as a laboratory. The other end of this bar would have been attached to a rotating drum and would trace out curves into what was called a sphygmogram. Note especially this position here, this screw, about which I'll say more in just a moment. The adjustment of that screw is critical to getting the machine to work. Although Marais touted self-inscribing instruments as superior to the unaided senses, praising the sphygmometer as the microscope of arterial movement, what he in fact proposed was not to replace the senses with machine readings, but rather to substitute one sense for another. More specifically, Marais hoped to re-educate the senses and to democratize skill by translating the delicate touch of the physician or physiologist into the legible trace of a self-inscribing machine. The tactile would be made visual and thereby accessible and articulate. Imagine, Marais instructed his readers, a physician endowed with exquisite touch and great patience, who after years of careful observation learns to diagnose diseases from the pulses of his patients. Marais remained unmoved by this achievement, querying rhetorically, how will he express to his students what he perceives? Will he find in them the natural tact, delicate enough to perceive the sequence of sensations he has come to distinguish only by long effort? Will he hope, by means of definitions or metaphors, to make them comprehend the nature of the tactile sensation? Marais doubted neither the accuracy of the physician's touch nor the accessibility of the patient's pulse. The patient's wrist is as much a public, shared object as the curves traced by the sphygmometer on a sheet of ruled paper. But Marais apparently took the graph produced by the sphygmometer to be immediately legible, with no help from language or skill needed to divine the secrets of the felt pulse from its peaks and troughs. To summarize, said Marais, the method we propose for the study of the pulse has as its goal to render sensible to everyone the very delicate nuances that escape the majority of physicians. Yet Marais' thick volume, 600 to 700 pages, on the graphical methods that were to rid science of intrusive language and obscure sensory impressions was testimony to the illegibility of the traces meant to replace them. Page after page explains how to read the traces that were supposed to require no deciphering. In the case of the pulse patterns rendered visible by the sphygmometer, Marais not only had to interpret their relationship to normal and pathological states, but also to re-describe them in precisely the words he had hoped to jettison. So, for example, the summit of the curve presents a form that is sometimes acute, sometimes flat. This from a man who had repeatedly complained that the ancient nomenclature of the pulse, large and small, wide and narrow, hard and soft, full and empty, fast and slow, pinched, raised, thready, formicant, bounding, had lost its meaning for many modern physicians, who therefore applied the vocabulary as so many idiolects, defining their sensations each in his own way. Yet Marais himself fell back upon a similarly metaphorical, and sometimes the very same vocabulary, to interpret the ascent, summit, and descent of the sphygmograph. Moreover, the language of skill did not disappear from Marais' treatise. He writes, one gropes, tâtonne, in applying the sphygmograph, and one graduates the pressure in turning the set screw, the screw that I mentioned a moment ago. The kind of curves that Marais was at such pains, at such length, to interpret look something like this. This is from not the sphygmometer, but rather from the myographia, that is, of muscular shocks. I'm sorry not to give you a sphygmograph. The problem was that the reproductions in the Marais volume were not of a crisp enough quality to permit further photocopies. But you get some idea of the patterns that would have been traced. You imagine a single curve for a sphygmometer rather than this plane curve. And the trick was for Marais to read off of, say, a curve like this, a diagnosis of the patient's ailment, for example, lead poisoning, which some physicians, at least those who were seasoned enough, could do simply by filling a patient's pulse. I come to my conclusion. How far could communitarian objectivity be pushed? How much of the ineffable could be made articulate, be it by words, symbols, or graphs? There are scattered glimpses in the turn of the century scientific literature of a kind of transcendent communitarian objectivity, one which would span not only different languages, investigative traditions, and levels of skill, but even different species. The German physicist Otto Wiener imagined a museum of self-registering instruments and other automatic experimental apparatus in which, as he says, a being endowed with other senses but with sufficiently developed physical knowledge and capabilities would be able to instruct itself in such a museum about the state of our knowledge. This imaginary museum, which Wiener incomprehensibly, to my view, thought was approximated by Berlin's Urania, foreshadowed the final goal of current research in physics, namely the creation of, quoting Wiener again, a theory at once unified and comprehensive and as independent as possible from the special nature of our senses. From the unity of scientists, now embracing other species as well as other nations, it seemed a short step to the unity of the sciences. This was, of course, a giant leap rather than a short step, and that on several counts. Wiener's conviction that a being endowed with other than human senses would find the graphical trace of a self-registering instrument immediately intelligible is as puzzling as Marais' belief that medical novices would do so. Moreover, the communicability of a theory, even to Martians or to angels, implies nothing about the unity of its structure, much less about the unity of nature. Yet the flight from anthropomorphism was a prominent theme in early 20th century physics, and it is striking that it was conceived, and not only by Wiener, as a transcendent form of communitarian objectivity. Max Planck, for example, attacked the phenomenological unification of physics and physiology proposed by Wilhelm Ostwald and Ernst Mach because it made peculiarly human senses the connecting link between these sciences. In its place, Planck proposed a different vision of unification, which elided the unity of objects and subjects of science. He wrote in his Columbia Lectures of 1906, "The aim is nothing other than the unity, the coherence of the system of theoretical physics, and indeed the unity not only with respect to all the particulars of the system, but also with respect to physicists in all places, all times, all cultures. Yes, the system of theoretical physics lays claim to validity not merely for the inhabitants of this earth, but also for the inhabitants of other heavenly bodies." This was Kant's criterion of communicability writ large, very large, and made into a broadside for intergalactic cosmopolitanism. Yet there's a subtle but significant difference between the assumptions underlying Kant's and Planck's formulations of the criterion of communicability. Kant assumed that it was the shared world and the possibility of true judgments about that shared world that underpinned communicability. Planck assumed this and more. For Planck, the world we share with Martians is not only uniform, but unified. Its content and order are not only universal, but coherent. Communicability had become a sign, not only for the objective, but also for the unified. But it remains only a sign, and to infer either objectivity or unity from communicability is to indulge in the risky business of inferring from causes to effects. Many causal paths may terminate in the same effect. Not all consensus betokens truth. Nor is the communicable coextensive with the real, nor even with accuracy, as we've seen. Communitarian objectivity, with its officious entourage of words, formalizations, and rules, has never wanted for critics among scientists and philosophers, who have repeatedly pointed to the importance of intuition, skill, and other forms of the ineffable in science. Yet even the most eloquent and vehement of these critics sometimes lapse into the lingo of communicability, as when Michael Polanyi noted that all connoisseurship in science and technology would eventually be replaced, he says, by a measurable grating, for a measurement has the advantage of greater objectivity, as shown by the fact that measurements give consistent results in the hands of different observers all over the world, while such objectivity is rarely achieved in the case of physiognomic appreciations, end quote. Does greater consistency necessarily imply greater accuracy? Is the ineffable necessarily less objective than the articulate? Despite the mountain of counterexamples amassed against the communitarian objectivity of the map, it retains its hold on our scientific ideals and practices. It is its tenacity, not its validity, that calls out for further examination. And we will understand the tenacity of our strangely confused notion of scientific objectivity only by understanding its history. Thank you.